Hey everybody, and welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined today for this very special discussion of Christopher Nolan's new film Interstellar by Adam Riske.
Hello, I hope you like soft teas because I'm pronouncing it Interstellar.
And JB.
I'm recording this podcast right now, but I'm just trying to get home. The most important thing is to get home.
Thank you both for having clever things to say when I introduce you. If this is your first time listening to the show, thank you very much for finding us. You should visit our website at fthismovie.net where you can find hundreds of our past episodes. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. Like our page on Facebook. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us in the iTunes store just by searching F This Movie. If you like the show and you're a fan, please take the time to leave a star rating or a review. I think we're just shy of 100, so let's see who's going to be our 100th review. I wish I could say you got a prize, but I don't know who you will be. Did I get everything? I think so.
Did you say that Stretcher thing?
Stitcher. Yeah, we're on Stitcher, but I don't know how to use Stitcher. If you're a fan of Stitcher and that's how you listen to podcasts, great. You can listen to us that way. But I don't know how to use Stitcher.
Also, if you're walking down a dark alley at night, turn around. We'll be there.
We're going to talk about Interstellar because we have to. And we're going to talk spoiler-free for a few minutes. It's the kind of movie that I think in order to really talk about, we need to get into spoilers. Because the marketing, I would say, doesn't give that much away. And so I would like to leave the movie a surprise.
I will give them a lot of credit for that.
Yeah.
The trailer did not.
The movie should be a surprise. Yeah. So we'll give some initial reactions and then we'll pretty much move right into spoilers. But before we do, this is our first post-Scary Movie Month podcast. So Adam Riske, let me ask you, have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, nothing fantastic, but I saw a few things that were interesting.
I'll take it.
I saw Stretch on Netflix.
As did I. That was going to be one of mine.
Okay.
Did you like it?
No, not really.
No, me either.
I'm a Smokin' Aces fan, and I know a lot of people don't care for Smokin' Aces, but yeah. I think it's underrated and fun. And this one's in a similar vein, but not as good. No, not nearly as good. And you can kind of tell that Universal was right for maybe not giving this a wide release.
Any release.
Yeah.
They had nothing. And if you don't know the story, Universal was, this is the new Joe Carnahan movie, and Universal was going to put it out this year. And then a few months before it was supposed to come out, they didn't just shelve it. They didn't like dump it straight to DVD. They literally just washed their hands of it, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like their logo was at the start of the movie.
Was. Okay.
But it's not even on DVD or Blu-ray yet. It just premiered out of the blue on Netflix Instant.
It showed up on VOD, so it's one of these Blumhouse Tilt titles, which is...
Blumhouse is the sinister people,
right? Blumhouse makes low-budget movies that make a shit ton of money. And so now they have this new label called Blumhouse Tilt, which apparently is like, these are the movies that aren't going to go to theaters. So they show up on VOD for like a few weeks, and then they showed up on Netflix because one of the other movies that I was going to talk about called Mockingbird is another Blumhouse Tilt movie, just showed up on VOD a few weeks ago and is already available on Netflix.
I'm waiting for Mockingbird Part 2.
So the window is very small, but yeah, Stretch was probably my least favorite Joe Carnahan movie.
I would say so also. There were little parts of it that I liked. Like, I thought Chris Pine, whenever he was on screen, it was entertaining.
But didn't you feel like it was a little bit too much forced? Of like, I'm not usually like this. Isn't this crazy?
Yeah, but it saved me from one thing that I just despised in the movie was the Patrick Wilson voiceover.
Sure.
And Ed Helms is horrible in it. Yes. It's just very...
Which is almost universally true these days.
Yes, yeah.
Ed Helms maybe needs to be stopped.
He certainly does. I don't know. I don't really want to talk about Stretch too much more. It was not That's good.
Fine. No, I wasn't...
Yeah.
I didn't love it.
Yeah, I'll probably recommend it for Netflix this week. And I saw a couple movies in theaters yesterday. I'm going to write a review on it, but I saw Big Hero 6. Did you guys see Big Hero 6?
Not yet.
No, but when Jan and I went to the movies yesterday, there were all these marketing people at a table outside of Big Hero 6 asking people to fill out this really long survey. And I thought, that was interesting. This isn't a sneak.
Yeah.
It's been released. I have a weird feeling that they're trying to change the marketing strategy or something midstream because maybe the Friday return wasn't what they expected.
Isn't Marvel associated with that movie?
It's based on a Marvel comic.
They don't seem to be pushing that angle in the
marketing. No, not at all. It's funny you should mention that because I didn't know that going into this movie. I thought it was just the next Disney animated movie like Wreck-It Ralph or Frozen. And then my big problem with the movie is first half of it is great. It's really charming and entertaining and cute. And then there's a nice dynamic set up between two brothers and then the robot that one of the brothers creates. And then they decide, and I won't spoil it, but they decide to change the trajectory of that story and it becomes The Incredibles mixed with Sky High. Okay. And you mentioned, JB, on other shows that you immediately lose interest when you see two CGI characters fighting each other.
Yeah.
I lose even more interest when I see animated action sequences. Animated action sequences, which Disney is all, they do it all the time. They almost always make me check out and get immediately bored. And Big Hero 6 ends with about 30 minutes of that. And the villain is really weak. And it just is a big bummer. And there's a Fall Out Boy song that's like getting kicked in the ear dick. Yeah, it's terrible.
That's your problem right there.
But I will say Big Hero 6 is worth seeing because the short before Big Hero 6 is called Feast.
I've heard
it's that like it's great. 5 minutes long. Yeah. It's the most charming, sweet, cute, just altogether perfect short that I've seen since Paper Man, the one that ran before Wreck-It Ralph. It's like that quality. And it's worth, just even if you don't want to see Big Hero 6, sneaking into the theater just to catch the short Feast. So,
well, I was going to say that presents a dilemma because I really liked the trailer for Big Hero 6. It made it look like something I would want to see.
Yeah.
And I don't go to every animated film. So now it seems like I should go for the short, and then for the first hour.
Yeah, if you like The Incredibles, but expect it to be a lot worse, then you might like Big Hero 6. And then I saw Laggies with Keira Knightley and Sam Rockwell.
You're a brave, brave man.
Okay, so this is a movie that exists in the 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on a Saturday window, where if you got nothing to do, you're fine seeing Laggies at 10:30 in the morning, but if you have anything else to do, like shower or like fold clothes or anything else, you're fine. I like Keira Knightley a lot. I like Sam Rockwell a lot. That was what got me into the theater. They have a romantic subplot. They have zero chemistry. It's sort of funny. It's just very kind of sitcom-y, and this is my first Lynn Shelton movie that I've ever seen, and it doesn't make me want to rush out and watch more Lynn Shelton stuff.
I would recommend Hump Day, which is, I want to say, her first movie, and is really worth seeing. And then it's been diminishing returns ever since. Your Sister's Sister was problematic, Touchy Feely was really problematic, and I have not yet seen Laggies. But
when you call up Laggies on the Flixster app that shows you all the showtimes and stuff, it says Laggies in parentheses, Say When. Was the movie originally called Say When?
Not that I know of.
Because having seen the trailer, that title would work.
I don't know. Yeah, it's just, it is what it is.
All right.
That's awesome. That's it.
All right, J-Bones.
Because of your review.
Yes.
And because I wanted to wash the taste out of my mouth of another film that will not be named, I went to see Nightcrawler and thought it was fantastic.
It is.
Now that I've been to L.A. a couple times to visit my son, it really captures, and I don't want to say it's, you know, okay, I won't say the David Wayne line.
I know the line.
Okay.
great radio.
Theater of the city mind. Is another character in the movie. That's the line.
That L.A. and its surrounding environs has this feel when you're there. And the movie captures that. And I think it's not an easy thing to capture because it's not the standard Hollywood or TV L.A. thing. Love Nightcrawler. You need to see it, if only for Gyllenhaal's performance, which is sort of amazing.
I think he's my favorite actor now.
My wife and I were commenting on the way home. It's gotten to that point. You saw it, right?
Yeah, it's terrific.
The scene in the Mexican restaurant between Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo is so well written. And that's becoming so rare. It's like, oh, the filmmakers are treating us with respect, and there's a lot going on under the surface, and it's not overstated. But oddly enough, I have to chime in as the old man on the F This Movie crew. It reminded me of something because you said you could imagine Lou Bloom becoming an expression that we use. The movie reminded me of a book by Bud Schulberg. I think it came out in the 30s or the 40s. It's called What Makes Sammy Run? And there was a character in the book named Sammy Glick who would do anything to get in ahead in Hollywood. And in fact, Sammy Glick became this term to talk about. And the more I thought about it, and obviously this is a theme that lots of artists like to explore, What Makes Sammy Run and Nightcrawler are very, very similar. And I appreciated it because we keep getting movies and television shows and books and plays and things about this because it's something we forget. What profits a man to gain the world and lose his soul? Nightcrawler's terrific.
It is. Ben Stiller has been trying to make What Makes Sammy Run into a movie for almost 20 years now. And I kind of hope he doesn't because I finally saw The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And let's keep Ben Stiller away from things.
Classic literary properties.
Have you seen Secret Life of Walter Mitty
yet? I have.
It's not a movie.
I thought it was okay.
It's not a movie.
It's not the worst thing ever.
It's a mess.
It's not a movie.
It's not as good as Satan's Little Helper.
It's a mess. But I would actually say there were a couple sequences I liked.
Okay.
It doesn't fit together in any way. It's almost like he started to make a movie and stopped, and then years later picked it up again. And then finally, 10 years later, did that. It's very episodic.
Like Silver Linings Playbook, I kept waiting for the reveal that all of this stuff that we thought was his actual life is just another daydream, because that's the only way most of it makes sense.
I was waiting for that as well. And I happen to know that Ben Stiller listens to this podcast, so I have a piece of advice for Ben Stiller. If you want to get that movie made, here's how you need to do it. You need to change the name to A Night at What Makes Sammy Run.
I like it. I like it. Anything besides Nightcrawler?
Oh, good Lord. That's foremost in my mind. And, of course, we're going to talk today about what we saw Friday night.
I will talk about two movies briefly. One I referenced already, and it's called Mockingbird. And it's a horror film that's currently available on Netflix Instant. And Adam Rusky, I almost encourage you to watch it because you loathed the houses that October built.
Yes.
With such veracity. This is way worse, I think. Mockingbird is another found footage movie, and it's a home invasion found footage movie.
Did you have to see this?
No. I was curious.
But you don't like found footage, so why don't you
Think I knew it was found footage when I put it on.
Okay.
And I had heard about the title, and the poster had a weird-looking clown on it, and I thought, sure, I'll check it out.
Okay.
Patrick's conscience holds a gun to his head and forces him to watch these movies. And by gun, I mean his dick.
It's a found footage horror movie told from the point of view of the victims. So it's like, people are trying to break in and kill me. Don't put the camera down. And they try and explain why they're not allowed to put the camera down. They're being forced to play this game. It's okay. So in the first 2 minutes of the movie, and I hope this isn't a spoiler because it's in the first 2 minutes of the movie. The movie essentially opens with a child who's maybe 10 years old being graphically shot in the head, including blood spray out the back, cut to opening credits. Oh, okay.
I'm out.
So, right. It's awful. It's offensive. It exists just to shock you, right? The movie never even gets that good again. and not to say that that moment is good, because obviously it's awful, but at least it pushes a button, right? And the movie never even does that again. The punchline that it builds to is shockingly insulting. The movie is not good, is my point.
What's better, this or Leprechaun Origins?
This.
What?
Oh, boy.
This. I still think this might be better.
Now we're going to argue the shit scale. I'm waiting for the found footage movie that's told from the point of view of the camcorder.
I like it.
I just sit here. I'm a passive observer while all of this Hurly-burly goes on around my land.
Did you ever see the Mr. Show sketch where they do the joke, the musical, where Bob Odenkirk plays the milk machine at the end? That's going to be the... And then last night I watched a documentary called Ivory Tower, which is supposed to be about the spiraling costs of higher education. And for 20 minutes, that's what it's about. And it gets you all worked up and angry. And you say, this is never going to change. This is inexcusable. What are we going to do about this? And then for an hour and 10 minutes, it follows whatever fucking path it feels like going down. Here's this other method. Ooh, look what they're doing over here. We lost sight of the thesis 100%. And then at the end, it ends with a little text thing that's like, if you want to learn more about debt management, visit this site, like call to action. But the last 70 minutes has had nothing to do with debt management at all. It was a failure as a documentary. It still presented some interesting things and some schools that I didn't know about, like some alternative approaches to college. But, man, it's a mess as a film.
You know what this sounds like? When Heath and I were at Wonderfest, we sat through that abysmal, not yet finished documentary. And it made me think that once documentaries became somewhat popular, people started to think that they were easier to make than they were.
Right.
Because it's like, you interview some people, and then you do some research on the internet, and then you can cut it together however you want. No. That's what this sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. So that's it. Let's talk about Interstellar. Like I said, we're going to go initial reaction, spoiler-free, and then pretty quickly move into spoilers. I saw the movie with JB Friday night. I know what he feels about the movie. So Adam Risky, I would like to start with you, sir.
Okay. So as I do with most podcasts for new movies that I see, I saw it twice.
Wow.
So
you deserve a fucking medal.
Okay. So that kind of tips your reaction a little bit. So the first time I saw it, I thought that there was a lot to admire and appreciate. I liked a lot of it, but there were huge problems that I had with certain sequences and characters. The second time I saw it, I kind of knew what I was getting into, and I liked it more.
Okay.
So I come down as saying that it's probably my fourth favorite of the Christopher Nolan movies.
The first three being?
They would be, in no particular order, Inception, Insomnia, and The Dark Knight.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think there's a lot of problems with it. I'm a huge 2001 fan. I think that it's aping 2001 a lot.
Pardon the pun.
But yeah, I didn't even catch that. But I don't think that movies work this hard usually, and I appreciate that. So that's kind of where I come down.
I will give it a lot of credit for being ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we've discussed endlessly on this podcast, the things that are released that people think are movies, it isn't even a movie, that people expect people to go to, I will give this film credit for ambition and scope.
Yeah. What else do you want to say? Anything? Or is that it? We're doing just initial reactions. You didn't like it.
Not at all.
Okay.
And if I could draw a really tenuous parallel, Cameron Clothier, who's a big friend of the site, posted a link to a video on the F This Movie Facebook fan page. And it's a video collector justifying his decision to not send back the special edition of Nightbreed when he was sent it in error because he ordered the cheaper one. And Scream Factory asked for it back, sent him an email, called him on the phone, sent him a box. And you've seen it. It's a 20-minute video where this guy defends shakily his decision to keep it. And after I watched that video, I looked at all the comments on YouTube, and the comments made me feel like I had gone insane. It made me feel that I was alone and that I'm the only man on earth who feels this way. I can't tell you how much I didn't like Inception.
It's Interstellar.
Oh, I love Inception.
Right.
Yep.
Just wheel my wheelchair into the scenario. Interstellar.
We'll push it off a cliff like in Mac and Me.
Don't worry,
you'll make it.
I swear to you, I'm trying to find something to like So when we got home, I read about 100 reviews of the film, both negative and positive. And what I discovered was, even in the positive reviews, people have big reservations. So clearly, I'm not alone. I like the performers. I've seen the performers in a lot of other movies, and I've liked them. I think the biggest problem here is the script. The script has enormous plot holes and some of the worst dialogue I've ever heard. So you have Casey Affleck, who I have so much respect for, and he's literally given nothing to do.
Yeah, I had asked Erica, maybe on the drive home, like, why did he sign on for this movie? And maybe it's just an opportunity to work with Christopher Nolan. Maybe more of his part was cut out, but he's not given much to do. I guess I would fall sort of somewhere in the middle. I think maybe I found a few more things to like than you, but overall, I did not particularly like the movie. I'm a Christopher Nolan fan, with the exception of really The Dark Knight Rises. I've liked all of his movies in varying degrees. Inception is still one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years. I love it. And like you guys had said, I appreciate the fact that he's a filmmaker who's given tremendous, he's just given carte blanche. Hey, go make what you make or what you want to make, especially after the success of the Batman movies. And between this and Inception, he's making these $200 million movies that are very ambitious, full of ideas. They are blockbusters unlike most other blockbusters. At the same time, I don't feel like he should be given a free pass. We create this dichotomy that, like, well, it's this or Michael Bay, and there's no in-between. And that's not fair, because just because he's not doing Michael Bay, for which I'm very grateful, doesn't make his movie automatically successful.
Right, and I would suggest, if you're talking about a continuum rather than a binary system of it's awful or it's this, that if it's some sort of continuum, well, Transformers is on one end of the continuum. I would suggest Inception's on the other end, and Interstellar is somewhere in between.
Yeah.
That it's neither fish
as are most movies
nor fowl. This film tries very, very hard to be profound.
Yes.
And I think it fails.
Yeah, I didn't get any type of emotional resonance from it. I think that and I would say, you know, the opposite end of that spectrum is, like, does it work intellectually? Like, I could say Inception doesn't make me emotionally invested, but right. Like from a mind game standpoint and keeping you engaged intellectually, it really works. A problem with Interstellar is that while I appreciate that almost all of the characters, with the exception of the Casey Affleck character, have clear motivations and you can understand why they're doing what they're doing, they over-explain it so much. They tell you every person tells you in dialogue why they're doing what they're doing.
And you had mentioned 2001, and someone had even posted something like this on Slate, that if you're going to make a film like this, you have to be more closed-mouthed and objective. That you had to leave it up to the audience more, because there are long stretches in 2001 mm-hmm. where you could be befuddled. And Kubrick has no problem with that.
Yeah.
What I see in Interstellar is, as we see a lot lately, it's two films battling each other. It's a really thoughtful, very complicated, scientific film that's full of scientific notions and theories about quantum physics and time travel. But you can't make a $200 million movie about that.
Right.
So the other half is this human drama that people can identify with. And you had talked about how everything is over-explained or maybe mis-explained, that the film falls all over itself to be friendly to people who don't necessarily want to spend 3 hours mm-hmm. pondering these large notions. My son was very dismissive when I talked to him about the film before I went to see it. And he dismissed Christopher Nolan as being the Diet Pepsi of serious filmmakers. That he's caught in this place where to spend that much money on a movie, it has to do this. But he doesn't have very much interest in doing that. So it's a film that fights itself.
I think so. I don't know. I'd have to disagree with that. Because I don't think that he's necessarily a quote-unquote serious filmmaker. I think that he's still making
popular entertainment.
So if you're talking about somebody like Oliver Stone being a serious filmmaker or something like that, like, I don't think Christopher Nolan has that aim. I agree with you that he's trying to do something profound here, and I think it's as clumsily done as something like Signs, which this movie reminded me of a lot.
Yeah, about halfway through, I'm like, this is a lot like Signs.
Which, and I don't know, can we go into spoilers?
Let's do that, yeah. So if you've seen the movie, continue to listen, or if you don't care about having it spoiled, continue to listen. But in order to really talk about a lot of the different aspects of this movie, we need to be able to be specific, so.
I did find one other thing to like.
Okay.
The design of the robot.
Yeah.
I thought was really intriguing.
Yeah.
And I've never seen that in a film.
Yeah.
And it made me sit there and think, is that really... Someone would say this is the best way engineering for the robot to do and move the way he likes. But again, my wife, who's much more observant than I am, there's a scene where everyone gets shaken up in the capsule and two people aren't strapped in. And the robot immediately assumes a position to shield that person. Mm-hmm. And she thought that was very worked out. Very well worked out.
One thing that bugged me, though, was there was no Rachel getting married callback because the voice of Tars is Bill Irwin. And then Anne Hathaway's there. And I just wanted something where he's like, you might know something about being a scientist, but you don't know shit about loading a dishwasher.
Yeah, right. He should have made her
load the dishwasher. I did not know because the seats that I chose for us, unfortunately, were at the top of the steps. Mm-hmm. So this big, tall guy had to stand there and put his hoodie on during the credits, and I couldn't see the credits. That's why I shouted that thing.
Got it. I was trying to identify the voice the whole time. First, I thought it was Cillian Murphy, because I was like, well, that would make sense. They worked together. Then I was almost positive it was William Fichtner.
Okay.
But it was Bill Irwin.
Did you guys see it in the 70mm, or did you see it in digital?
We saw it in IMAX.
IMAX, okay.
But not 70mm.
I believe it's digital. In this area, the only 70mm is Navy Pier.
Yeah.
No, Lincolnshire had it in 70mm.
You're kidding.
I saw it there the first time.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
And how was it?
I wasn't as wowed by it as I did when I saw, say, The Master in 70mm. It just looked like 35mm to me.
Okay. Did you see The Master? I don't mean to interrupt. Did you see The Master in 70mm at the Music Box?
Yes.
See, my understanding was the only two theaters that still had 70mm projectors were Navy Pier and the Music Box.
Well, maybe it was 35. I don't know. I saw it in their true IMAX theater.
Right.
And it was actually a little distracting because it goes back and forth between like widescreen and then like giant IMAX screen. So it gets a little, you gotta have to get your bearings back every once in a while.
I didn't find that. I noticed it a bunch of times, but I wasn't too distracted by it. And I was actually concerned because I deliberately sought out the IMAX presentation because a lot of things I read were, well, you got to see this in IMAX. And I'm ultimately very glad that we did because I think it's a movie that deserves that treatment. But one of the things that I'd read was the IMAX sound mix is garbage and it makes it hard to understand some of the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was true of a few moments, but I felt like it was mostly stuff I didn't need to understand. It was them shouting commands on the ship or something. The only issue that I had was I thought the last few lines of dialogue were actually a little bit obscured, and I thought that might have been nice to make that a little clearer. Yeah. But I'm actually really glad we saw it in IMAX because, and you had commented, JB, that it was uncomfortably loud at times and there was a bass rumble that
was
affecting
you. There was some subwoofer activity that was just, and you both of the guys who were, you and your friend,
yeah,
had said that there were points where it was uncomfortable.
Yes.
And I wondered if that was deliberate.
Yes. I mean, I think so. See, to me, that added to the experience. I actually liked that.
And now we're in spoilers, so let me bounce this off of Mr. Risky.
Yes.
The first time the subwoofer goes crazy is when he's sitting with Murph in the bedroom and telling her that he's leaving. And underneath that conversation, there's this crazy subwoofer.
Well, you know the reason why.
I think you're going to say what I said in the lobby after the movie.
Okay, well, you say what you're going to say.
Because later we discover that during that scene, he's somewhere else in another dimension behind the bookshelf, so to speak, and that's Nolan indicating his semi-scientific supernatural presence.
Are you talking about before he's, like, in the truck and driving off and, like, she's running out for him? Because
no. It's when the two of them are in the bedroom together talking.
Oh, I never noticed the subwoofer part.
Oh, it was...
Because one of the scenes I really liked was just immediately after that was when they cross-cut the launch with him leaving. I thought that was
terrifically done. I liked that too, and one of the reasons I liked it was because we skipped all the bullshit where, like, he trains or whatever. I mean, he didn't need to because I know it's established that he's already a pilot, but...
I would argue that the film needs more of those ellipses, and again, shout out to 2001 that has the most famous ellipses on Earth, the bone turning into the space station. Would both of you agree that the film is overlong?
Yes. Yeah, I would say it's about a half hour too long.
And one final thing about the subwoofer, because I found this hilarious. Yesterday, I saw Nightcrawler at the same theater, and I was standing in line to get my treats, and...
You can hear it.
Beyond that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the floor was shaking.
Yeah.
When I saw Big Hero 6, I was next to a theater with Interstellar, and it was just like... It was like, I'm Bamer.
And I turned to the concession worker, and joking, I said, hey, as if I hadn't seen the movie, is Interstellar loud? And we're both shaking. And there was this pause, and he looked at me, and he said, you have no idea. And I thought, these guys, like, should get hazard pay or hearing protection.
Yeah.
Can you imagine
having
to work next to that?
It's loud. I thought that was one of the things that worked for it. Christopher Nolan is often accused of being emotionally chilly, that his films don't have a lot of heart.
This film falls all over itself to prove that wrong.
Yeah. See, and for me, the only emotional stuff that worked for me in this movie was because of Matthew McConaughey's performance. I thought he sold certain moments that would not have otherwise worked.
Especially with certain lines of dialogue. He had a way of kind of offhanding some really clunky lines.
And here's the thing. Like, I know that people are really liking this movie and really responding to the movie, and that's totally fine. Because I think it just gets to a point where, we've said it before, like, you're either on board with it or you are not. And it's not that I'm incapable of a movie that is sort of nakedly optimistic and emotionally vulnerable, because I've talked at great length about my affection for Cloud Atlas, which is about as gushing and optimistic a movie as can be. This movie tries to do some of the same stuff, but I couldn't go along with it. And so when it was, the universal constant is love, and the fifth dimension is my daughter's bedroom, and I'm the ghost, all that shit, it's like... You can either go along with that and surrender yourself to the movie. I was not able to.
Going along with what I said previously about the film trying to cover all bases, it's like the most shameless thing to keep pandering to this thing, because everyone has a family and everyone has loved ones, and so that has to be the anchor.
But maybe it may not be pandering. Maybe that's the story he wanted to tell. Love is the constant. Right?
Hold on. I just lost the thread.
So wanted to ask you guys, the movie I thought was excellent for about an hour and a half. And then when we got to the sequence with Matt Damon, which is a spoiler because
that's problematic.
Nobody really knew that he was in it. When Matt Damon turned evil, I almost audibly went, oh no. Yeah. Like, it was, why do you have to go there? Like, and obviously that's the center section of 2001. It's the hell sequence, him going
down to the airlock thing, which is just...
It's ridiculous. Come on. It's ridiculous. You know
that people are going to compare.
And some of the dialogue they give Matt Damon to say is just unbelievably ham-fisted. It's just, he's like, I can't watch you. I'm sorry. I thought that I could. It's like, why don't you just turn your back?
That line I actually kind of liked. When he said, I thought I could watch it, but I can't. Well, I thought that was interesting.
Well, one of us is right.
Much like Bill Murray.
But I agree that a lot of his lines were rough.
Much like Bill Murray in Zombieland. I was just so happy that I saw it on opening night, and that wasn't spoiled for me.
Right.
Because when they unzip him, I'm like, I didn't know he was in this, and I like him. And actually, I think this is true of every actor in the film. I liked his performance.
Mm-hmm.
I liked his performance a lot, but he's stranded with this unplayable character and unspeakable lines. The script is bad and the dialogue is worse. And one final comment about that. I think you were talking about how Matthew McConaughey got you through the first hour. Because I agree his performance is strong, although I wish the script was better. Throughout the first hour, I kept thinking, True Detective has altered his career.
Sure.
Because now he is going to be hired to recite endless speechifying.
Sure.
I would argue the speechifying in True Detective is better, but he's really good at that.
Yeah.
He's really good at selling it and making it understandable.
Yeah, he's an actor that, I mean, like everybody else, I was really sick of him for a long time. And then around the Lincoln Lawyers, when he turned his career around, yeah. He started giving really honest and just kind of lack of vanity type of performances. And then this one, I mean, he's just so relaxed and natural, and it's just like invisible acting. He really nails that everyman. But you believe that he's, you know, an intelligent...
Yes. And that's hard.
Person, yeah.
You believe that he's really sharp, and everything I've read about test pilots, like in The Right Stuff, the book,
yeah.
He effortlessly conveys that in all the scenes where he's actually in control of the ship, and he's doing something incredibly risky and dangerous.
Yeah, I would say that he gives the only standout performance in the movie. It's not really a performance movie, but I can't think of anybody who really gets moments or dialogue or anything they don't that have they characters. Can really do.
They don't have characters to play.
I thought John Lithgow was wasted, and I like John Lithgow. Yeah. I thought Casey Affleck was wasted. And Michael Caine, I think what bothers me about that is I really don't think the poem works in the movie, and it certainly doesn't work to repeat it as many times as they do. I think Jan made this joke first, but Back to School actually uses Do Not Go Gentle Is That Good Night better than Interstellar. And while we're in the realm of spoilers, I would argue that Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure handles time travel better than Interstellar.
Yeah, I was
because in essence, they're both playing the same game.
Okay.
One thing that I like, and I'm going to try to avoid a certain movie that is a very popular space movie from last year that I'm not a fan of, which I've talked about ad nauseum.
Well, no, I think you need to say the name.
Gravity. I don't like Gravity.
And I do.
The reason why I don't like Gravity is, okay, I'm a real sucker for space exploration. I think that Interstellar has a curiosity about space exploration, and they're trying some stuff, especially with Gargantua and going through that, and with the
what a black hole would look like,
and the endurance and like it's spinning into space and everything like that. And they have some moments where there's genuine awe there, I think, for space and for exploration, and I think it's just really enchanting almost. With Gravity, I felt like it was a movie where it's like, okay, we're in space, we got to get the hell out of here. And it didn't really have that much interest in exploring.
Well, no, it didn't, but that's not the story it was telling. I mean, you can't hold that against the movie.
Well, I'm just saying from a personal preference perspective.
Sure. It wasn't enough about space.
Yeah, and my point isn't to harp on Gravity. My point is more to say that from the curiosity of space perspective and showing me some cool stuff in space, I think that Interstellar had a lot of that, and especially in the first hour and a half. The problem, and I wanted to ask you guys this, is I think the movie would be so much better, and it would be about a half hour shorter if they just cut out all the bullshit on the farm and all that stuff, like, after they're in space.
Right.
Just cut all that out. I mean, like, I understand...
To see, like, what the kids are doing.
Yeah,
why she's burning all his corn.
Exactly.
It's a weird choice.
And why Casey Affleck wants his family to die.
Yeah.
Inexplicably.
But not his corn burned.
Not his corn burned.
The film is so long, at that point, when Jessica Chastain sets fire to the cornfield, it's a subliminal suggestion for the audience to go out for more popcorn.
Well, it at that point, it just kind of became a sequence from Days of Heaven. Gosh, I don't even know where to start. There are moments in the movie that made me excited, like you're talking about with some of the space stuff. I thought some of the different gravity things were really interesting. Like, hey, if we're down there for an hour, it's 27 years on Earth. That's super interesting. And one of my problems, and maybe this isn't fair to say it's a problem, is that I felt like a lot of the You have said the movie falls over backwards, bends over backwards to try to be sort of emotionally manipulative. But I felt like almost all of the emotion fell short because it skips over it. It's like he comes to the realization that they've just lost 27 years and they're pissed at Anne Hathaway, but it doesn't really register at all. And then at the end, not to jump ahead, but like he finally sees his daughter and she's an old woman. And that should be such a moving scene. And she's like, I don't want you to see me die. Get out. And he's like, all right, peace. And he backs out of the room. And it just skips over what I feel like should be big moments.
And that is the climax. Because this is screenwriting 101. Dad leaves and goes through hell to get back.
Right.
I mean, that's as old as the Odyssey.
Right.
So the climax is the conversation you have with your daughter, who paradoxically is now older than you. But here's what I mean by bending over backwards, because this is what I really hated about the film. In Nolan's opinion, the climax is him stealing the spaceship to get back to Anne Hathaway, because she's available now because that other guy died. What the fuck is that?
I don't know that the movie's saying it's romantic, but okay.
Yeah. Then why is he going back? To save her? To rescue her?
Well, she needs.
Why is he going back?
Because he has no other place.
I'm not allowed to talk about the movie's treatment of women, apparently, because somebody in the comments had said, "Yeah, don't bring that up." But the movie has some problems with its female characters, I would say. Anne Hathaway is set up as a brilliant scientist who just wants to go to the planet to see her boyfriend, and yes, the movie validates her by saying, "But she was right, and love is the constant." But that moment sucked the air out of the movie so much for me that it says, like, well, I want to go to this planet because that's where my boyfriend is. Just sells that character so short. And then the two things she does in the movie are need to be rescued and fucks up on water planet. Like, those are her two big moments. Anyway.
And in terms of the film inspiring awe, and this shows the difference between you and me, Adam.
Yeah.
I found more genuine awe in Gravity than in Interstellar. But in trying to find something about this movie to like, because I really want to like it, because I'd like there to be more ambitious,
yes, absolutely,
thoughtful $200 million movies. The entire sequence on the water planet,
yes,
I thought was great and really well done and genuinely exciting and genuinely disturbing in terms of how are they going to get out of the situation. I thought that was done well.
I liked it, but one thing that bugged me was once you saw how fast, I can't remember if it was Tars or Case, but the robot. Why didn't they just have the robot go out there and do all that stuff?
I thought the same thing. And I thought it was interesting that when they say, like, well, she probably just landed, the earlier pilot who had crashed and died. Like, she probably just landed. That's such an interesting idea. Yeah. When he goes into the black hole at the end, I was like, ooh, fucking A, this movie's going to go here. He's just going to swim into a black hole because he's McConaughey. And for me,
you'll never look at a library bookshelf the same way again.
None of that stuff worked. The realization that, oh, he's the ghost and the fifth dimension is
that's
his
your
daughter's
stuff,
bedroom. It just the movie for me could have ended with him going into the black hole. Like, let's see what this looks like. And then the end, McConaughey dies in the black hole.
But that's the next stage.
And it should have been like, well, then it would have been completely 2001. Or like, it's this Mobius trip where
he winds up in this Edwardian hotel room where he sees every stage of his life simultaneously.
Exactly,
That stuff didn't work for me. I had this theory that I started devising yesterday that the whole movie is this weird, I won't say bulletproof, that the movie steels itself against criticism by actually being about Nolan's career, in that it's a movie that says, like, let's not settle for this shit. We need to be better. We need to think bigger. We need to try harder. We need to be more ambitious. And that is what the movie is trying to do, to the extent that when it goes to the other planets, that they are examples of other blockbusters that the movie says, no, fuck this. So we get to big CGI wave planet, and we've seen how many fucking CGI wave movies, and we say, no, this won't do. And then we go to Ice Planet, coincidence, where Matt Damon is there, and the movie becomes this dumb chase movie where Matt Damon's trying to kill him, and we're like, no, 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 that's fucking stupid. Let's get out of here.
Like the levels in Inception.
Yeah, sort of. I don't, that's not actually what he was trying to do. I do not believe that for one second. But I just thought it was maybe an interesting reading on the movie. I think the movie is unfortunately more literal than that.
Two quick things, because I think we have time, right?
Sure.
Okay. One, if this film is trying to be thought-provoking and profound, I ask you two gentlemen, what is it saying? Because driving home Friday night, and I'm a thinking man, thinking about the film Friday night and discussing it and continuing to think about it Saturday, and that's why I went to Nightcrawler to wash the taste of Interstellar out of my mouth. All right, if this something. Film is profound and thought-provoking...
Which I haven't said that it is.
But would you both agree that it's trying to be? It's trying, with all Get Out, to be...
Sure. I don't know that I walked away with much. You know, I'm not walking away really thinking about a lot of things. And I don't think
we have to summarize art in one sentence. That's not what I'm looking for. No, I know. But I'm wondering what this movie is saying.
While you were in it, at least it was getting you to engage in certain things. Obviously, the dialogue was distracting and there were storytelling issues that were problematic. But certain things you could pull out of it while you were watching it and engage with, oh, that's interesting,
that idea. I think there's some people who like it because it's big and loud.
Maybe.
One other thing I like, because I'm trying to give this film credit, the whole notion, this is major spoilers.
That's okay.
What I found fascinating was that the Michael Caine character knew that you couldn't send people out there with this. They had to think this.
Yes.
Because in response to that, driving home, my wife said, you know, in business books I've heard, the best plan for making plan A work is not to have a plan B.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it was fascinating that the Michael Caine character could be objective enough, and this is his daughter, to send them out because he knows saying this will get them to go, but that's not what it is at all. It's this other thing that you're positing as the fallback. I thought that was interesting and should have been explored. It's your daughter.
And those are the things that, at least while I was seeing the movie, that I was engaging with. When the movie was over, no, I'm not necessarily thinking like, wow, man, love is the answer. And love is the whole thing. I mean, when that when Anne Hathaway flat out says that about halfway through the movie, it felt so clumsy. I mean, there were just...
I think the Beatles said that better.
They were really clumsy lines. And I mean, I take issue with the idea that, like, we're NASA and we're building in secret. Wait, that NASA? Yes, that NASA. And this whole building is going to launch into space or something.
I did like that future textbooks present the moon landing as a
PR move. Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating.
I thought that was a little bit heavy-handed. Yeah. But I did like a lot of the future stuff. I liked the idea that the movie was establishing a future that felt very much like our present with some changes. And I liked the sort of realism of the future. Even the robot is maybe the most quote-unquote futuristic thing we see, but it's still it's not a dude walking, a guy walking around. It feels like a thing that was built.
At the beginning, we're allowed to discover things.
Right.
Although, and this is not unique, this is not original to me. Again, this is something my wife brought to the party, that in a worse film, you'd have all this narration
of course.
Telling us what happened.
Of course.
But I would argue, as does my wife, that how Nolan errs is that he presents narration through dialogue.
Sure. And that's always been one of his problems.
The film goes along.
Rewatch Inception. That's a lot of characters explaining shit to each other.
Because clearly in both films, there are things that need to be explained. So I have a lot of respect for both of you. Both of you are very bright. Help me with this for 2 minutes. McConaughey goes on a mission. And then, through a bunch of scientifical stuff, winds up behind his daughter's bookshelf in a tesseract where all moments in time
exist. Are you going to ask what she figured out?
No.
Okay.
Here's what I want to know.
Deus ex machina is what she figured out.
That he's moving the books and doing other things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, back when she was small, she got it. stay.
Right.
So McConaughey is trying to send himself the message to not go.
Right.
But he did go.
Right,
yeah.
And clearly, it's future people who made the Tesseract possible for him to do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But for that to happen, they need the information that McConaughey and the robot bring back.
It's a plot hole.
No, it's time travel. Every time travel. But if you didn't do this, then you could never have done this. That's every... And that's one of the fucking great things about Looper. We need to talk about Looper more. Is just Bruce Willis flat out fucking saying, I don't want to talk about time travel. Like, I'm not interested in
that. In the reality of the narrative, I just don't see how it makes any sense.
Yeah, it was something that I was puzzling over.
And it's not even presented as a paradox. It's not... Dwelled on at all.
At that point, does he know that it's future people that built the...
Well, for a long time, we're meant to think
I know, that it's aliens, which, yeah. I'm trying to remember. Is it just him in the...
I thought it was the moment,
like, sort of this emotional reaction, I have to get myself to stay, not realizing that if he were to convince himself to stay, that he wouldn't actually be there. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Two things. One is I wanted to get back to what you were saying about what this movie's trying to say, because I'm going to try to stitch something together.
Okay.
What I think that it's trying to say is, all right, so remember the name of Matt Damon's character. It's Dr. Man, and man is evil. So I think they're saying, and also man is the one who's saying that stop space exploration and you should, you know, just kind of accept your lot with this dying corn land and the Dust Bowl and all that. So I think, and then technology is always presented as being good in this movie. I mean, it's the robots, they never malfunction, they never do fucked up shit. They're always like, and it's advancing. So I think what the, and then there's the whole plot about, you know, people, when you have children, you're a ghost for your kids' lives and everything like that.
That's an interesting line.
So I think that what they're trying to say, and I'm really trying to stitch this together, I'm not sure if I even believe it, but what I'm coming up with is that we need to keep advancing, we need to embrace technology, that is forward progression is what's going to keep us going, that doing our own selfish interests from man is what's going to be the end of us.
And there's even a line about that. It's very early in the film. I think it's John Lithgow who says, everybody wanted these things, and that's what led to this, which many critics are assuming is his reference to, it's some sort of climate change scenario, and it's our bad use of technology. I like what you're saying, Adam, because one thing that I really liked, and I like this discussion because it's making me see things in the film that I like, is when Anne Hathaway says, and I'm only paraphrasing, nature is not evil. It's harsh and uncaring, but it's not evil. I thought that was terrific. I can chew on that for a couple days.
I felt bad for Anne Hathaway's character because, like, at least with Casey Affleck, he's giving, like, McConaughey, like, people updates, but then, like, all Hathaway gets is Michael Caine poems. Like, imagine she's just, like, up in space. She just wants to talk to her dad, and he's just like, let me recite to you some Robert Frost.
And then he's saying it again.
But McConaughey is really the only character in the movie who exhibits traits, like, through action, through performance, through dialogue. Every other character in the movie exists, like, we could describe them. Murphy, for example, is really only pointed to by every other character in the movie as, oh, she's a pistol, she's smart, she's a firebrand, we need to get her. They all describe Murphy, but we never really, I mean, she's pissed off, but we never really get to know her, and that's a very important character
of show don't tell. And it would have been fairly easy in the interminable first 45 minutes of this movie to show her doing something.
Right. Well, she does get on the truck and hide under the blanket. And it's weird how little he cares about his son. He's very caught up in his daughter. But he's like, you know, you have two kids, right?
Yeah, I wanted to mention that he couldn't give a shit about his son at all.
But there is the one scene where he's being told that his son's future has already been forecast.
And right, exactly.
He's upset about
and
they just needed to, like, when he brings up Casey Affleck on the video, he just, like, fast forward. He's like, where's Murph? Where's Murph?
I feel like we could talk about this movie for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Not longer than the movie itself.
Which is good and bad, because I think a lot of our conversation would still be like, oh, when I had a problem with this, and what was up with this? But I think there, in the course of that, we would also find things to like about it, or at least that we found interesting. So
it made me wish that there was a real Tesseract, and I could go into it, and I would end up behind the Blu-rays, mm-hmm. giving myself a secret message to not go see Interstellar.
Do you really wish you hadn't seen it?
It was the film I was most looking forward to this year.
Okay. That doesn't answer my question. Do you wish you wouldn't have seen it? Because you can say hyperbolic shit, like, I wish I wouldn't have seen it. But that's not true. You saw it and you didn't like it, right?
I say hyperbolic shit all the time.
Okay.
It gets people's attention.
I found it to be frustrating. I found it to be disappointing because I was excited about it.
I'm glad I saw it. Yeah. And it is not, by a long stretch, the worst movie I've seen this year.
There's no way it could be.
I was hoping that when they revealed what the Morse code said when the books were falling off the shelves, it just said, you own too many books.
Anyway, so let's stop our conversation about Interstellar. Like I said, we could keep talking about it, but...
But Topher Grace, we didn't talk about Topher Grace. Oh, yeah, we forgot to mention.
He shows up.
He's in good company.
Topher Grace.
Patrick's not going to say it, so this should be the last thing in the podcast. I think you waited until the movie was over. Or did you lean across and say this during the movie?
I don't know.
Matthew McConaughey comes back to Earth, talks to his mother, who's now, I believe they said she's 108. Mm-hmm. So medical science has advanced.
Ellen Burstyn.
But that's not Ellen Burstyn at the end.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
With even more makeup than in the... Yeah. Okay. I think it was either during the movie or after the movie, Patrick leans across and says, my mother gets older, I stay the same age. All right, all right, all right.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Goodbye.